I don't know how many of you noticed the subtitle of that last song that we sang was "Why Should I Feel Discouraged," which goes along with the most depressing day of the year. So it fit in there nicely, so thank you for that tie-in. Also, thank you for all the songs that talked about the Lion of Judah today. Wow. Today we're going to get back into the story of Joseph, and I don't know if you noticed, there was actually two stories that I missed about Isaac and Abraham, and today I should have told both of them because they're going to come back and I just didn't like them. I should go back to them. So we will talk about that. And the other thing we're going to talk about is Goshen, which is fitting because I'm going to Goshen this week. So I won't be here next week because I'll be coming back from Goshen. If you think about it, do pray for me on Friday and Saturday. I am at a conference of Amish and Mennonites talking about two topics that I wouldn't cross the street to talk about if I didn't have to. And so they're both very difficult topics that I'll be talking about during that conference. I'm one of many speakers, but I will be speaking at a conference there in Goshen at Maple City Chapel. For those of you who know any of the churches in Goshen, is where we're going to be at. So today, where we're coming back to is, speaking of the Lion of Judah, we ended the last time in Genesis at looking at Judah's plea for his brother Benjamin. And we got to see that Judah had made this transformation in his life, and many take it back to Tamar and the way that Tamar dealt with him. Now, what's weird about that story, in my view, is that many people say that when Tamar tricked him and then said to him, "Hey, come and see which man owns this seal and this rod, this staff," and he comes in private and he sees it, and he is hit with how different she approached his sin compared to other things. And so what people have hypothesized is that Judah made the choice: I am going to give up the life of deceit and revenge, and I'm going to seek to live a life of forgiveness and love. And so from that point on, Judah's mentioning in the Bible is one of those themes. And so this appeal that he gave for Benjamin in the end of chapter 45 is, again, like I said, many people believe the greatest passionate speech given to plead for someone's life in the Bible. The other thing I wanted to point out before we get into chapter 45 here today is that the Bible really slows down and gets into more detail in this story that we're just going through right now than any other story in the Old Testament. It slows way down because it is such a significant turning point in the history of the country of Israel. And so it also shows more emotion than the Bible usually shows, particularly in today's sermon. You're going to see a lot of emotion, and so that's what we're going to get to today. So, to set the scene about what we're getting into, the 12 brothers are in the private house of Joseph, and Joseph has eaten with them. And again, we talked about how Joseph is in this weird in-between, that there was three tables set up. There was a table that Joseph ate by himself, there was a table for his servants to eat, and there was a table for his brothers, because again, the Egyptians would not eat with the detestable Hebrews or Canaanites because they were considered below them. And as we're going to find out today, another strike against Joseph's brothers where they were shepherds. Shepherds were even the lowest of the low because sheep were considered filthy animals. And so anybody who worked with sheep were considered to be detestable people, and we're going to get to that at the end of our story today. So Judah has made his appeal, and he ends with it: "Now please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in the place of the boy, and let the boy return to his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? Do not let me see the misery that would come on my father." And again, Judah not only makes an appeal for Benjamin, but also the concern for his father. Then in chapter 45, verse 1, "Then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants, and he cried out, 'Have everybody leave my presence.' So there was no one there when he made himself known to his brothers. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him. Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. When Joseph said to his brothers, "Come close," and when they had done so, he said, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. Now do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourself for selling me there, because it was to save lives that God sent me ahead of you. For two years now there has been a famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be no plowing and no reaping. But God sent me ahead of you to preserve you for a remnant on the earth, to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but God. He made me father to Pharaoh, lord of this entire household, lord of his entire household, and the ruler of all Egypt. Now hurry back to my father and say to him, 'This is what your son Joseph says. God has made me the lord of all of Egypt. Come down to me. Do not delay. You will live in the region of Goshen and be near me. You and your children and your grandchildren and your flocks and herds and all of that you have, I will provide for you there, because 5 years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your household and all that belong to you will become destitute. You can see for yourself, and so can my brother Benjamin, that this is really who I am speaking to you. Tell my father about all the honors accorded to me in Egypt and about everything you've seen. Bring my father down here quickly.' And he threw his arms around Benjamin and wept. And Benjamin embraced him weeping, and he kissed all his brothers and wept over them. Afterwards, his brothers talked with him." Now, Joseph, when he hears Judah's plea, and he gets to see Judah's heart, and he knows that Judah has been transformed, and Judah is not the same Judah who sold him into slavery, he breaks down. He can't take it anymore, and he yells for all the servants to leave. You wonder what the servants thought. What was going through their head? Why in the world is Joseph ordering us out of the room with these men that we don't even know who they are? You wonder what his brothers thought. I'm sure they thought, "We're dead," or "He's going to do something crazy." Now, everybody leaves. I don't think that his brothers expected him to break into weeping. And this is just not your ordinary weeping. He wept so loudly that the Egyptian servants who left could still hear him through the walls. By the way, that's the way we know he didn't grow up Mennonite. If somebody who's Mennonite wept that loudly, you'd be terrified. But he weeps loudly, and his brothers had no idea what to do, I'm sure. He then says to them, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" By the way, the Bible downplays this. But his brothers were unable to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Now, Jewish guesses here is they were so scared that their souls left their body for a short period of time and they became ghosts. I don't think that happened. But I'm sure they were terrified. Can you imagine that this guy in front of you who is an Egyptian leader says, "I'm Joseph"? The man that you thought's been dead for 22 years. You really don't know. You've lived with a secret, and here he is in very front of you. I will say, it probably took them a long time to move. And I don't know what they would have done during that time. Then again, he says to them, "Come closer." This is where many people believe that he showed him the circumcision, because that would have been the true mark that he was Joseph. Because who else would have had that? And then he says, "I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. Now, do not be," by the way, listen to this, "do not be distressed. Do not be angry at yourself for selling me there, because God sent me here to save your lives and to save our lives, because there's been 2 years of famine. There's going to be five more. But God sent me here to save you so that there would be a remnant." Now, I want to pause here for a second, because that's quite the statement. And I think it says, again, this is a type of Christ and how Christ forgives us. Christ forgives us in many ways. I'm going to point out three ways that Christ forgives us, that the way Joseph forgave his brothers. And I think these are all steps for us and how we can forgive too. Number one, Joseph forgave his brothers before he even met them and before they even asked. When you look at this statement of what Joseph makes here, when he says, hey, do not be angry, do not be distressed. What happened someplace along the line is that Joseph had worked through his anger and his bitterness towards his brothers, and he had forgiven them way before he met them. I don't know when he did that. I don't know when that happened. My guess is it's a process of time. It doesn't happen. Forgiveness doesn't happen instantaneously. Again, I talked about this before, so I'm not going to talk about it long, but I think I agree with those that say that there are two kinds of forgiveness. There's decisional forgiveness and there's emotional forgiveness. Decisional forgiveness is when I choose to forgive you. Emotional forgiveness is when I feel warm and fuzzy towards you again. Those are two different things. I was reminded of when looking at this, when shortly after we moved to Pennsylvania, had a situation where I was deeply hurt by somebody and had to interact with that person off and on. And so I knew that it was hard for me to be in the same room with that person. And it was difficult to be with them. But I worked through that and I knew that I would forgive. I determined I would. And it took a while. It took months, if not years. But you know, the other day, Twyla and I ran into that person again, not expecting to. And, you know, we sat down and talked, and I didn't think about that situation that happened when I first moved here way back then. Never said to that person, hey, I forgive you. Don't need to. Why? They don't even know they probably hurt me. Forgiveness can take place without the person asking for forgiveness. Jesus forgives us when we don't ask. Now, we have to claim that gift. But Joseph reached the point of forgiving his brothers before they asked and before he met them. Number two, Joseph forgives his brothers in private and he doesn't drag them through the mud. One of the things that I really appreciate about this story when I look back at it now is that when he ordered all the Egyptians out of the room, the Egyptians probably didn't get to know this dirty little secret. When Joseph's brothers came back, I don't think that they knew that they sold Joseph into slavery. His wife, I'm assuming, knew. I'm assuming a few of his very close servants knew. But Joseph forgives them outside of prying eyes. He forgives them in the room by themselves. And he doesn't say to them, hey, I've spent 22 years in the pit. He doesn't even mention that. He just says, don't be distressed and don't be angry with yourself. Wow, what a thing to say. He doesn't say, hey, I'm going to forgive you, but I'm never going to let you forget all those years of pain that I had to endure because of your horrible thing. Doesn't come up. Number three, Joseph forgives from the eternal perspective. He's able to see that God had a plan. And that he was playing a small role in God's plan by being sent to Egypt to save the remnant of the people of Israel. I think that made it easier for him to forgive his brothers. Because he realized my brothers did, in fact, in Genesis 50, when we get there, Joseph says what? You meant this for evil, but God used it for good. See, God is able to use things that are done for evil. He can redeem them and turn them into good. He can make them part of his plan, which again is sometimes hard for me to figure out. How in the world can God hate evil so, but use evil to accomplish his plan? But he does here. God uses this, and Joseph was able to piece this together. I don't know when Joseph figured this all out. I don't think it happened right away. He had 22 years to do it. And I'm sure that he had some good days and he had some January 23rd days where it didn't look so good. Because that's the way life is. But I think sometimes when we can find it easier to forgive people, One of the things that I, in my job now, I work with people who are asked by church leaders to forgive people that they hang out with and go to church with all the time. And so they have these kind of required forgiveness sessions. And wow, that's been an interesting thing to walk through people with. And to forgive somebody before you're ready to forgive them is really hard. But I think sometimes it's easier to forgive when we can think about it from God's perspective, and we can think about that God can restore and redeem whatever happened to us in a way. Not that it takes away our pain. Now, the other things that I want to point out here is in verse 8. See, when we talk about the patriarchs of Israel, we talk about Abraham, the silent one, Isaac, and then Jacob. The one we don't talk about is Joseph. But if you look at verse 8, he says what? He has made me the what? Patriarch to Pharaoh. Joseph has the special distinction of not being a patriarch of the children of Israel, but to be the patriarch of Egypt. Which is just a strange positioning of Joseph. Especially when you think about Egypt symbolizing sin and slavery and being bound up. How in the world do you put that in? And I don't know the answers to that, but we know that we get to see here that he is the patriarch to Pharaoh and to Pharaoh of Egypt, which keeps him separate from the patriarchs of Israel. And also, look here. Now, so verse 9. Now hurry back to what? Not our father. Hurry back to my father and say to him, this is your son, Joseph says, God has made me Lord over all Egypt. Come down to me and don't delay. You shall live in the region of Goshen and be near you. You and your children and grandchildren, your flocks and herds and all of you, I will provide for you. And there will be 5 more years of famine are still to come. Otherwise, you and your households and all who belong to it will become destituted. And then in verse 13, and bring my father down here. When he talks about their dad, he talks about him as my father, my father, my father, my father. Now, I mean, some of that is he haven't seen his father for a long time, but it always strikes me. Why didn't he say our father? I don't know. Other than, again, he's certainly thinking about something about the loss of that relationship. Now, again, he also says, you can see for yourselves, and so can my brother Benjamin. That special relationship that he has with Benjamin is not broken. In fact, who is the first person he kisses and hugs and cries over? It's Benjamin. But the thing that I like the most is not his kissing and tugging of Benjamin, because I get that and weeping, but the verse 15, and he kissed all of his brothers and wept over them. Joseph didn't make any distinctions. He didn't single out Judah and said, I don't want to kiss you and hug you because of what you did. He doesn't single out Reuben, but he kisses and hugs every one of the other brothers and goes down the list. By the way, I try to imagine what it would be like to see Joseph coming and think, he's going to hug me and kiss me after what I did. Is he going to stab me in the back while he's hugging me? What a weird, weird time this would be. For those of you who have ever been in situations where there's animosity between you and somebody else, to just do that would be hard. Now they didn't know, right? They didn't know what was going on. And then in verse, at the end of that passage, afterwards his brothers talked with him. What do you imagine they talked about? They had a lot to talk about. Wow, what a conversation. Wouldn't that have been great to be a mouse in the corner to just listen to that conversation? I don't know who asked the most questions. I think they both asked questions, although I would guess his brothers didn't have a lot of questions. I just kept thinking they had to be thinking, this is Joseph? This is the man who we expected to die on his walk across the wilderness to slavery? This man who looks like an Egyptian who's in front of us? But again, remember that that's what Jesus invites us to do, to fellowship with him and to talk and walk with him. after his forgiveness with us. There you go. Joseph finally meets his brothers. They have their reunion. They have somewhat of a restoration. I still think it took years for them to really get comfortable with each other. I want to show you something in the next passage we read here. Joseph can't help but be, well, let's just read. Verse 16, when the news reached Pharaoh's palace that Joseph's brothers had come, Pharaoh and all his officials were pleased. Joseph must have been deeply loved by Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Joseph, tell your brothers, do this, load your animals and return to the land of Canaan. Bring your father and your families back. I will give you the best land of Egypt and you can enjoy the fat of the land. You are also directed to tell them, do this, take some carts from Egypt for your children and your wives and get your father and come. Never mind your belongings because the best of Egypt will be yours. So the sons of Israel did this. Joseph gave them carts. By the way, carts are going to be the same thing that donkeys were last Sunday. We're going to read about carts and carts and carts. So Joseph gave them carts as Pharaoh had commanded, and he also gave them some provisions for their journey. So each of them, he gave new clothing. But to Benjamin, he gave 300 shekels of silver and 5 sets of clothing. And this is what he sent to his father, 10 donkeys loaded with the best things of Egypt, 10 female donkeys loaded with grain and bread and provisions for their journey. And he sent his brothers away. And as they were leaving, he said to them, don't quarrel on the way. I wonder why he said that. So they went out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan. And they told him, Joseph is alive. Who in the world had that task? In fact, he is the ruler of all of Egypt. And Joseph was stunned and he did not believe them. And when they told him everything Joseph said to them, and when he saw the carts Joseph had sent to carry him back, the spirit of his father, their father Jacob, revived. And Israel said, I am convinced my son Joseph is alive, and I will go and see him before I die. Now, again, Pharaoh must have really loved Joseph. Because he is pleased when he discovers that Joseph's brothers are here, and he tells Joseph, hey, bring your brothers back and settle in the land of Goshen. Now, we're going to find out at the end of the story, Joseph had been pulling strings already to get to the land of Goshen. Reminds me of a long time ago in a class that I had when I was, 18 years old, when Twyla and I had just met. And the question on the test was, why did they settle in the land of Goshen? And I could not think of the answer for that for nothing. It still haunts me. But that, you know, we remember the things we didn't do well. Now, so he had pulled strings to get them to live in the land of Goshen. The land of Goshen was one of the richest, most fertile parts of Egypt. And he says, he talked to Pharaoh. Pharaoh already knew that. And he said, bring your father and your families back and I'll give you the best of the land. You can live in the fat of the land. Don't worry about your belongings back there. I'm sure Pharaoh's thinking, the trash that they have at home, just leave it there. There's nothing very good. You don't have much. Don't bring it. And he sends him carts. Now, these carts, so this is what people say. Those carts were carts that you could ride in, that you could you weren't doing walking and carrying on the back of a donkey. It would be like sending jumbo jets into a remote jungle to get a remote tribe to bring them out. People would have been talking for a long time about these carts that went down, and we're talking 600-800 miles to get this family that lived in the middle of no place. And he sends these carts down to get them. But before they go, he gives each of his brothers a set of clothes, except for Benjamin, who gets what? 5 sets. By the way, that favoritism keeps coming through. Now, remember one of the things we talked about early on? That every time Joseph loses his clothes. He loses his cloak with Potiphar's wife. He loses his coat when he's sold into slavery. And look what happens. He gives his brothers coats. Jesus, what? Clothes us in righteousness. Joseph gives his brothers a new set of clothing to represent a change of life. Because again, in this story, clothing means a change. Clothing means a way of life. Clothing means the loss of something. Here it means to gain something. And Benjamin gets 5 sets of clothing, that favoritism. And he gets what? 300 shekels of silver. Wow, that's a lot of silver. Favoritism. But again, do his brothers seem jealous? Do his brothers seem upset? Maybe. That's why Joseph said to them, what? Don't quarrel along the way. He knows his brothers well, doesn't he? Or his old brothers. So they go down. I think Joseph was also like, come on, guys. You got to make this trip. You got to make this trip fast. Please don't spend too much time quarreling and fighting along the way. Keep moving. But I think he also knew his brothers, and he's thinking, these guys are going to fight. They're going to do something stupid. I got to keep that from happening. So they left, and they would go down to the land of Canaan, and they tell Jacob that Joseph is alive. Again, I don't know how they told him. I'd have loved to have seen that. How do you explain that? How do you tell your dad, well, remember we told you? Now, to be fair, if you go back and read the details, they never said that Joseph was dead. They just made it pretty clear that he was. Or they led Jacob to believe that he was, again, the family of deceit. Somebody had the, I hope it was Judah, but somebody had the task, probably Judah or Reuben. He was stunned and he didn't believe them. But when they told him everything that Joseph had said and he saw the carts probably were pretty convincing. How else could you explain that your sons who had gone down to Egypt came back with these magnificent looking carts? It's hard to make sense. Now, if you really deep into the type of Christ, the best way to have a testimony about Jesus is to what? Tell others about the words that he said and the things that he has done for you. Because that's what they did about Joseph. That's how Jacob began to believe Joseph was alive, was when they, what? Told him his words and the things that he had done for him. And then in verse 28, how does verse 28 go? Look at what happens in verse 28. Moses, in writing this, changes. Whenever we see Moses changing Jacob to Israel, we know that Jacob is probably speaking out of the spirit and not out of his flesh. And he says what? Israel said, I am convinced my son Joseph is alive, and I will go and see him before I die. This is the man who just recently said what? Everything is against me. If I send Benjamin down there, it's going to be a disaster. And now he's completely turned around. He says, oh, I get to go and see Benjamin. I saw see Joseph before he dies. By the way, he lived with Joseph for how many years? 17 years. How many years was he with Joseph in the original? 17 years. He gets 1 year paid back for every year that he was with Joseph before. Okay. So, verse 46, or chapter 46. So Israel sets out with all that was his. He reaches Beersheba, and he offered sacrifices to God of his father Isaac. And God spoke to Israel, in a vision at night. And he said, Jacob, Jacob, here am I, he replied, and I am God, the God of your father. He said, do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back, and Joseph's own hands will close your eyes. Joseph, and then Jacob left Beersheba, and Israel's sons took their father Jacob and their children and their wives in a cart that Pharaoh had sent him to transport him. So Jacob and all of his offsprings went to Egypt, taking with them their livestock and their possessions that they had acquired in Canaan. And Jacob brought with him to Egypt his sons and his grandsons, his daughters and his granddaughters, and all of his offspring. So, yep, thank you, Dan. You are good. So you all, this you probably can't see this, but the red line is the first trip his brothers took from Hebron to seek Joseph, their brother, which they didn't know. The blue lines are their trip back and forth, and the green line is the trip that Jacob and everybody took to get from there. And as you can see, he gets to Beersheba and he stops. Beersheba is right on the edge of the promised land. They're going to Goshen over here. And it's estimated to be about 800 miles, a little bit over 800 miles between there. And they get to Beersheba. Beersheba is important in this family because Abraham was there for a while. He lived there for a while, and he planted a tree because he said, I'm planting this tree unto the Lord, because he and the Lord had some special things. There were some other things that happened in Abraham's life that wasn't that pleasant there. And then Isaac lived there, and he built an altar. And so maybe the reason that he says that he offered sacrifices to the God of his father, Isaac, the one that we know the least about, and not Abraham, was because this was Isaac's altar that he actually sacrificed on. So he sacrifices to at Beersheba, right at the edge of leaving the promised land and going to Egypt. He stops and he offers a sacrifice, and God appears to him in a dream, just like he did at another journey way early on. Now, here's the story that we didn't cover. Abraham goes to Egypt once upon a time, a long time ago, when there was a famine in the land. And this is when he does the crazy thing where he passed off his 65-year-old65-year-old wife as his sister, because he said what? She is too beautiful. She's 65 years old. She's too beautiful. They're going to think that she's my wife, and they're going to kill me so that they can marry her. He went to Egypt because of a famine. Jacob's dad, there was a famine in the land. He wanted to go to Egypt. The Lord appeared to him and said, don't go to Egypt. And guess what he did? He passed his wife off as his sister so that he wouldn't be killed. The same thing that his dad did. They did the same crazy thing. So I'm not surprised that Jacob is saying, God, I'm a little nervous here. I'm going to Egypt because there's a famine. And you know what? You told my dad not to go, and my dad didn't go, and he had this mess up with my mom. And then my grandfather did go, and he messed up. Am I really supposed to go to Egypt? I think that Jacob's fear here is okay. I'd be scared to death too. My dad and my grandfather went, and bad things happened to them. And God's statement to him in the dream is so fantastic. I am God, the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will surely make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will surely bring you back. And Joseph's own hands will close your eyes. I can't help but think Jacob cried when he heard that. He knows that he's going to live with Joseph until he dies. Joseph is going to take his eyes that stay open because he's dead, and he's going to close them for him. What a promise. What a reassurance. And Jacob gets to leave Beersheba knowing that God is with him. Now, the other thing that's really cool, he tells him that I am going to make you a great nation. Now, you all, here's something that's really cool. God had told, when God was making his covenant, and Dan, I forget if I slipped that's in there this morning. Did I slip in Genesis 15? I think I did, verse 12. No, I did. So way back at the very beginning, when God was making a covenant, his covenant with Abraham, look at this. He slides something in there that we don't often think about. Remember, to make a covenant this time, you had to slice animals in half and you had to walk between them. A lot bloodier than putting can you imagine buying a house now, splitting animals, cutting animals, and walking between it with your banker? It's so much nicer to just sign it with a piece of paper. But when they're walking through, the sun was setting, and Abraham fell into a deep sleep because, you know, God couldn't walk between the dead animals. And a thick and dreadful darkness came over him, and the Lord said to him, know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be stranger in a country not of their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated here. But I will punish the nation that served a slave, and afterwards they will come out as a great possession. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and buried as a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here. This also shows you the grace of God. Why did they have to go? There's so many reasons why the children of Israel had to go into the land of Egypt for 400 years. One of them is the sins of the Amorites are not reached to the point that God is going to punish them. And so God sends all, God foretold, my people would go to Egypt for 400 years when he was making his covenant with Abraham. Now that plan is kicking into action. He is taking Jacob from Canaan and he's bringing them out of the land of Canaan to preserve them, because they are going to be what? Disgusting to the Egyptians. They're going to be a stench in the Egyptians' nostrils, and so therefore they won't intermarry them. But he's also protecting the Amorites until their sin has reached its fullest. That's what about is going to happen. So God is telling Jacob, go down with confidence, because this is a good thing. This is a good thing. Verse 5. That Jacob left Beersheba, and Israel's sons took their father Jacob, their children, and their wives in the carts. There's our carts again, that Pharaoh had sent them to transport them. So Jacob and all of his offsprings went to Egypt, taking their livestock and possessions they acquired in Canaan. Jacob took everything. Took everything they owned, which I can't imagine was a whole lot, but he took everything. It reminds me of some sense of King and Country's song, Ships Burned, or Burn the Ships, I think is the name of the song. They weren't going back. Now, God does tell him what? I will surely bring you back. Joseph made sure that they brought him back, right? But he doesn't come back alive. Now, I'm not going to read the descendants, because I can hardly speak English, much less when I try to pronounce things in Hebrew when they're there. So here, though, you all, we get to see who went to Egypt. We get to see all of his grandsons and all of his sons. Here's Reuben's sons, here's Simeon's sons, and here's Levi's sons, some daughters. And then here's Judah's sons. There's Perez. We know who Perez is, right? Tamar. There's Issachar, Zebulun. And then by the way, these are divided by his wives. And then go to the next one here. Asher has a few children. And then next slide. You know, we keep calling Benjamin the lad, or Benjamin the son, the boy. Look at this. Benjamin has more children than anybody here. He's a boy that has many boys. So then, what we see here is what? All those who went to Egypt with Jacob and his direct descendants, not counting his sons' wives. So all the men, they of course, many times they didn't count the women back in those days. Counting them, there were 66 people who went to Egypt, including, though, that doesn't include Joseph, Jacob, and his two sons, meaning 70 men went to Egypt. 70 men went to Egypt. How many men left Egypt 400 years later? 600,000. Think about this, you all. In the first 200 years of God's plans for Israel, they went from one man to 70 men. 215 years. One man, 70 men. That's kind of slow. In the next 400 years, we went to 70 men to 600,000 men. Also shows you why you should put your money in the bank early, compounding interest. But here's the thing that I want to remind you of. God's plans often start slow and sputter around, and we get frustrated with God. Why are you so slow? You're going to make a great nation. 215 years to make 70? You'll return before we get to 140. 400 years, 70 to 600,000 men. By the time you count wives and children, it was over probably, you know, between 1.5 and 2 million people left Egypt. God works at a different time frame than we do. God has a plan. God planned this all out way before Joseph, way before any of these things. He knew where he wanted his great nation to be. He knew that he wanted his great nation created in the protection of Egypt. Sometimes pain and difficulty are necessary to make us ready and able for God's plan. Verse 26. Verse 28. Now Jacob sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to get directions to Goshen, before GPS. When they arrived in the region of Joseph, region of Goshen, Joseph had his chariot made ready and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. By the way, can you imagine Joseph pulling up in a chariot to meet his dad? I don't know what that chariot looked like, but I just try to imagine Jacob, the man who lived for 22 years thinking his son was dead, pulls up in a chariot. As soon as Joseph appeared before him, he threw his arms around his father and they wept for a long time. The favorite son and his father are reunited. Wow. I'm sure Jacob cried and cried and cried and cried and couldn't stop crying. Israel said to Joseph, "Now I'm ready to die since I have seen for myself that you are still alive." Jacob is ready to die. The man who just three chapters ago said, "Everything is against me," is now what? He's gotten much more than the grain that he was looking for. He has seen the restoration of his relationship with his son. And he's ready to die. This is the best we get to see Jacob in his walk with God. This is where we get to see him in his most faithful. Now, people, the critics say, well, of course he's faithful. He got everything back. I know. But in that process, he's been transformed. The thing to remember, though, too, is that Jacob is just like us. What if we had our stories written out in the Bible like these men do? Would our stories be any different? Mine wouldn't. I've had the same test over and over again, failed them before, had to do them again. Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and speak to Pharaoh and will say to him, 'My brothers and my father's household who were living in the land of Canaan had come to me. The men are shepherds. They tend livestock and they brought them from their flocks and their herds and everything they own. When Pharaoh calls you in and asks, what's your occupation?'" Joseph's going to give them the answer. "Your servants have tended livestock from their boyhoods on, just as our fathers did. Then you will be allowed to settle in the region of Goshen, for all the shepherds are detestable to the Egyptians." Like Jesus, who is our advocate before the Father, Joseph is an advocate before Pharaoh for his family. He says, he's gone before and he says, "Hey, I want you to give my people the land of Goshen." And then he goes up before him and he makes a deal with Pharaoh, and then he tells his brothers and his dad, "Hey, remember, tell them you're shepherds, because that's detestable and they'll want to get rid of you and send you to the farming region of Goshen so they don't have to see you detest your detestable beings." We too have an advocate before the Father, and that's Jesus. The other thing that I want to point out is that Joseph sent Judah ahead of him to find directions. This is where we get to see Judah becoming the Lion of Judah. He begins to have his messianic role way before Jesus is born. But that's where we get to see that change. What's the lessons for us? Number one, how do we forgive like Joseph forgave? How do we forgive way before we meet the person, way before the people ask? How do we keep from becoming bitter and angry in what is done to us? If you've never had a chance to forgive somebody yet, wow, I hope you never do, but if you do, I don't know how you haven't. But we all have to decide, like Judah, do I walk in the way of revenge or do I walk in the way of forgiveness? The other thing is, God's plan is mighty, God's plan is big. How do we find our way into God's plan? How do we figure out how we fit into God's plan so that we can walk in that plan? It's not our plan. It's God's plan. How do we continue to see that from the eternal perspective? Let's pray. Father, we do thank you that you have a plan. Father, so often it's frustrating because that plan doesn't have us as part of the center, and sometimes we're the ones that get hurt as a result of that plan. But Father, help us to remember that you love us and you care for us, and that you hurt when we hurt, but you don't protect us from that hurt all the time. Father, thank you that you have given us these examples of flawed people so that we are not pressured into thinking that we have to be perfect. Thank you for your grace, as we sang today, that our sins are many, but your grace is, your mercies are more. Father, thank you for that. Help us to cling to your mercies, which are new every morning. In your name, amen.